Hi, Aaron Henkin here, and I want to welcome you to a new WYPR program, a program we're calling Life in the Balance. We're setting out here to create a monthly radio show about people, specifically people whose lives are at the root of so many of the policy discussions that we hear on these public radio airwaves. The policy talk and the analysis are important precisely because they are about real people. The people who represent what's at stake behind the numbers and the statistics. The people whose lives literally hang in the balance. What you're going to hear on this program is a fair share of thoughtful analysis from folks in the policy and academic and nonprofit worlds. But on each episode of this program, those conversations are going to be inspired by and in service of one person's firsthand account of his or her own life. So how's that going to work exactly? Let's find out together. There are more than 22,000 people incarcerated in the state of Maryland. Almost 8,000 of those people are from Baltimore City. Until 6 years ago, Danny Miller was one of them. Our program today is dedicated to Danny's story. We're going to start that story back when he was a teenager, when something happened that turned his life upside down.
I mean, to be honest, I kind of grew up kind of rough for real. And pretty much like my only friend I hung with was my brother, that's it. I was 14, he was 16. He was murdered. Yeah, he got shot in his back 2 times. It's pretty much we're dealing with selling drugs. It was kind of like a little turf war going on. He wasn't a target, to be honest, but they were shooting at somebody else. But he was there, and he so happened to get hit. But the guy they wanted to shoot only got shot in his hand. And my brother got shot in his back twice, then he ended up dying. Like a couple hours later. So like once that happened, a lot of things changed, like far as my focus. Before that, I went to school a lot. I never saw a bad grade. I rarely got in fights. You know, I always stayed to myself. Like once that happened, I stopped going to school, started being in the street a lot more, selling drugs and hanging with the wrong crowd. And once that started happening, I just started experiencing going to juvenile facilities, and from there went to jail, and then from jail went to prison. I mean, it pretty much shaped the mood, everything that's going on today. I had a homeboy, and I mean, it sounds crazy though, because he was my best friend for real. Like, we just started bumping heads. I mean, like, it seemed petty, like girls. I had a girlfriend. And like, she's always come to me like, man, you did this, you did that. And she kept knowing everything that I did and kind of found out it was him going back, telling him everything, just telling everything. After that, every little thing he did, I bottled it up. Instead of letting it out, I just kept like holding it, holding it, holding it. And then one day it was on his birthday. I had a girl with me, he had a girl with him. And I was like, man, I'm gonna get rid of my girlfriend, get rid of yours. We're gonna hang out together without the girls. So I ended up getting rid of my girlfriend. But he still had his girl with him. So I'm like, man, look, man, you got her with you. I don't want to hang with you. It was something so small like that. And we got into a big argument. We got into a little fight. It wasn't nothing big. We always fought and shook hands right after we finished fighting. Now, but this particular day, you know, we was drinking a little bit. And he just kept on calling me the B-word. Like, man, you. And I was like, man, call me another one. And he called me another one. And we started fighting. I had a knife on me, and I just swung it. You know, I ain't aiming or nothing. I just swung the knife. And I walked off like it ain't really hit me. And then somebody like, man, he died. So once they said he died, that's when it hit me. I used to be in his house every day. I called his mother, mother, you know. Yeah. And you know, he died. Something was so small like that. Like, we wasn't enemies. It wasn't no... nothing. We just had a normal fight that we always have. We was drinking, and I had a knife on me, and I don't know why I did it, but I did it.
Danny Miller sharing the story of a fight that turned into a murder that would land him behind bars. We're going to hear more of Danny's story as this hour progresses. He'll tell us about those years he spent in prison, and he'll tell us about what life has been like since he got out. This is Life in the Balance. I'm Aaron Henkin, and listening to Danny's story along with us is Carl Alexander. He is founder and director of the Thurgood Marshall Alliance. That is a group that provides technical support to schools in Baltimore that are committed to socioeconomic and racial diversity. He is also the John Dewey Professor Emeritus of Sociology, having retired from Johns Hopkins University back in 2014. For 25 years, Mr. Alexander followed the lives of 790 kids growing up in Baltimore neighborhoods. A lot of them ended up in prison. Mr. Alexander turned those years of study into a book. It's called The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. And Mr. Alexander, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me what you hear in Danny's story. Are there things in this story that sound familiar to you from your own research?
Oh my goodness, yes. It's hard to know where to start. I feel like I know Danny, and I just heard a brief clip of the story that he's got to share with us. And good for him for sharing it. That's very courageous for him to do. You mentioned the book, The Long Shadow, and there are many Dannys covered in that book. What comes immediately to mind is a little story that's included to illustrate the challenges that many of these young people face as they grow up in difficult circumstances, much like Danny's. In the book, we refer to this fellow as Chris, also African American. He also witnessed his brother being killed in their house when the house was invaded by thugs over a drug deal that went bad. And what Chris told us, he recounted the story when he was a young adult, probably age 26 or so. This happened when he was 12, 13. And he said that, not an exact quote, it's in the book, but he said, it's a hurting feeling when you lose someone that close. And as a result of his experience of this kind of violent trauma, he found it difficult to go back to school because he didn't want to have people at school see him cry. And he would cry every time he thought about his brother. Can you imagine, you know, being young and impressionable and having to live through that and then kind of get on with your life?
Let me ask you to talk more about that idea of trauma, what that word means in terms of how it can psychologically and emotionally impact a kid like Danny or like Chris, who you were just talking about, when it's experienced on a regular basis and over a period of time.
Yeah, and sadly for many of the young people growing up in Baltimore, that's their reality. It's not just a one-time experience. Yeah, witnessing a loved one murdered right before your eyes is probably the most extreme that you can imagine. But these young people are exposed to traumatic experiences, I won't say daily, but often in their lives. You know, it's a world that middle-class children growing up in the surrounding communities just don't know. And thankfully, they don't. But too many of our inner-city children experience it. We know from a broader research literature that the experience of violence at the neighborhood level, not even necessarily personal violence, spills over into the schools. There's a really remarkable study that was published some years back that demonstrates that in the neighborhood surrounding a school, if there's a murder that occurs within 2 weeks of standardized achievement testing, test scores plummet. So there's also a kind of a contextual reality to this. It's not just the up close and personal experiences of individuals like Danny, although that's certainly a large part of it, but there's also what happens outside the house in the neighborhood, exposure to violence and criminal activity.
I want to turn our attention now back to Danny Miller's story, share another part of his story. It turns out his brother's murder was not actually Danny's first experience with gun violence. It did, ironically, have to do with his brother, though.
Like before all this happened, I got shot by my brother because he had a gun. I was over my mother's house, and he called me like, come home. I was like, why? Man, I got a gun, man. Come home. I'm like, all right. And I came home. So like it was like the excitement of having a gun. We kept playing with the gun, playing with it. And you know, around this time I didn't know about if you pull it back, one go in the chamber. So I took the clip out. I took all the bullets off the clip. And I laid them on the bed and I put the clip back inside the gun. Then my brother picked the gun out. I'm like, man, you took the bullets out? I'm like, yeah. And he started playing with it. And he just pointed at me and just pulled the trigger.
Where did it hit you?
It went in my face right here. And it came up the back of my neck. It came up the back of my ring. I was 13 when it happened. It was January 97 when it happened, matter of fact. And he ended up getting killed October 97, the same year.
Carl Alexander, just how common or uncommon is a story like this? And how does this speak to what you know from your research about the saturation of guns and gun violence in the city?
So, of course, every situation is unique. And Danny's reality isn't necessarily the reality of what was experienced by young people living on the same block. But when you step back and you look at it collectively, this is all too common, exposure to violence and being victimized by violence. The study of ours that played out over a 25-year period, we were very successful in monitoring the progress of these youngsters as they grew up and got on with their lives. At age 28, 29, we identified and re-interviewed 80% of the original group. We couldn't arrange interviews with roughly 167. That's a very precise number because it's in my head. And that was a disappointment to us. But as we researched it and tried to understand why we're experiencing so much challenge in getting back together with them, we discovered that 28 of them were deceased. So that more than 20% of the young people whose lives we were part of since they were 6 years old, more than 20% of them that we couldn't interview as young adults were no longer with us. And that gives you a sense of the challenges and the risks of growing up in dangerous neighborhoods and unstable families in places like Baltimore. Now, you have to be careful not to paint with too broad a brush, because not everyone falls subject to victimization. Lots of these young people have proved to be very resilient and hardy and have managed to overcome many of these challenges and move on to comfortable, successful lives. But too many of them stumble along the way and experience these kinds of difficulties.
When somebody does stumble, is that the end of the line for them? How can you begin to undo the kind of corrosive effect of that kind of sustained trauma?
I think that we've got some useful ideas along those lines that are actually embedded in life histories that we tried to organize in the book, The Long Shadow. One of the interesting facets of what we were able to do is that we were able to compare the experiences of poor white youngsters growing up in Baltimore against those of poor African-American youngsters. There are lots of poor whites in Baltimore City and in places like Baltimore City, but they're often off the map when you start thinking about urban disadvantage, because we tend to think of that in racial terms and families of color. But what we discovered as we looked into this and with the experience of these young people is that the low-income whites, the poor white men in particular that were included in our study, they got in trouble too, just as did the African-American. The arrest and incarceration percentages for African-Americans was roughly 60% African-American men. For poor white men, it was in the order of 50-55%, so, you know, both too high. The poor whites, when we asked about problem behaviors, they told us that they did lots of things that their parents and we would not want them to do. They actually had higher rates of drug use, marijuana use, binge drinking than the poor African-American men. These guys were not saints. But what we discovered, despite all that, was that as young adults, the poor whites had much greater access to stable employment and that paid a decent wage. And they were working substantially, 45% of them, a remarkable statistic, in the remnants of Baltimore's old industrial and craft economy. So they were electricians, they were plumbers, they were auto mechanics. They did that kind of work with their hands. African-American men of like background growing up in very similar circumstances, very few of them were employed in that sector of the economy. And so these guys, the white guys, were actually well-positioned to live a comfortable life and to follow a path that would keep them out of trouble, whereas African-American men didn't have those opportunities. In the book, we talk about two success narratives. Doing well in school is the way to move up. And, of course, you know, middle-class parents hold that out for their children, as do low-income parents. But only about 4% of the low-income folks that were included in our study completed college. And so not many of them were able to follow that path. The alternative is to find good, steady employment that pays well and allows you to live comfortably and support a family. And that's where we saw these huge racial disparities, which favored working-class whites over working-class African-Americans. And I think the lesson in that is to help expand employment opportunities for poor blacks to allow them to kind of get on with their lives and recover from how they might have stumbled along the way. I mean, so these lower-income whites, as young people, did a lot of things that could have followed them for the rest of their lives, but they were able to get beyond it because they were given an opportunity to get a decent job. And And these employment opportunities opened up early. We think it's a story about social networks and social isolation. So a lot of these young white men, while they were in high school, they were helping out an uncle, a neighbor, someone from the church, getting good work experience, someone who would vouch for them when they went off and looked for a job, and they were building up a skill set. African-American men didn't have access to those social resources. And so when the time came to try to get back on track after spending after maybe being locked up for a while, African-American men didn't have any place to go. The young white men did. And that made a tremendous difference in their opportunities and well-being as young adults. So I think starting early, sure. And there are things we can do to help young men like Danny get a second chance. And most of them, and probably Danny as well, are eager to have a second chance and to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. We need to help open some doors for them, because the people who care most about them and are closest to them don't have the wherewithal to do that for their children and for their family. And so someone, if we care about them, somehow, some way, we have to step in and help open those doors.
Carl Alexander is a professor emeritus of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and author of The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. And Carl Alexander, thank you for your perspective.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Aaron Henkin, and you're listening to Life in the Balance. Coming up, the next chapter of Danny Miller's story, his struggle to keep sane in the face of a 30-year prison sentence. We'll also be joined by a local business owner who makes it a point to hire former inmates because he's one himself. We'll be right back. I'm Aaron Henkin. Welcome back to Life in the Balance, a radio program where we dedicate each episode to understanding one person's story and explaining the issues, social, economic, and political, that have shaped that story for better or worse. This hour, that story belongs to Danny Miller. Danny grew up in Baltimore, as we heard in the last segment of our program, in a neighborhood saturated with drugs and guns. He was accidentally shot by his brother when he was 13, and later that same year, he witnessed that same brother get murdered by crossfire in a drug-related shooting. We heard Danny tell about the emotional toll his brother's murder took on him, and about how when he was 17, he ended up getting into a drunken fight with a friend, a petty fight, but one that escalated fast. Danny pulled a knife and took an impulsive swing. It was a split-second decision with irreversible consequences. Danny's friend died, and Danny ended up in front of a judge.
I knew I was guilty, and I knew I couldn't beat the charge. So I was 17 at the time. So, you know, a lot of older guys like, man, if you get 10 years, you can do like 5 years on 10. You still young. You'll be home by the time you're 22 and all that. So I started looking for a deal. But it didn't go that way. And they gave me 30 years, you know. And I felt like everything was just over with. But, I mean, I had to deal with it, you know. Like, I'm here now. There's nothing you can do, you know, pulling and crying about it. You just gotta deal with it. And during this time, I had about 13 months in. So I was kind of adjusted to being in jail. But you can never really fully adjust yourself, but I was kind of adjusted to it. And I always just had in my head, like, man, I'm gonna come home. And the public defender, she told you, don't worry about it. In 3 years, just get your GED, and we're going to come back to court, and they're going to take it back. So that always just stayed in my head. So I always had hope. She like, man, because she put her arm in something called a modification. But I ended up going for my modification, and they denied it. So that's when the reality really hit me, like, man, you got to do this time. So I pretty much got adjusted for the fact that, I mean, you around a bunch of men that got all kind of charges. You got people that prey on people. So I couldn't really show that side. Like, you can't really show a sign of weakness in prison because the people would prey on it. So even though I felt messed up on the inside, I never showed it. So eventually I just like got it. I got used to it. Oh, breakfast gonna come this time. We gonna eat lunch this time. I got used to, the jail gonna get locked down. You can't get visits. So it's like every day I got to the same routines. I was adjusted to it. I mean, after a while, you don't have no other choice. You end up killing yourself in there, I'm telling you. I done seen people kill themselves, like, from, like, not, like, getting adjusted to it. Cause it'll send you crazy. I mean, it sent me crazy a little bit. Like, I started taking medicine. I started getting anxiety real bad, depression. So I started taking all kind of depression pills and anxiety pills, pills for insomnia, like things like that.
Danny Miller sharing his state of mind as he adjusted to the reality of a 30-year prison sentence. Danny's story is the inspiration for and the anchor of our conversation this hour on Life in the Balance. And listening to Danny's story, along with us right now, is a man by the name of Chris Wilson. Chris is a Baltimore-based social entrepreneur and founder of a number of local businesses, including the Barclay Investment Corporation, specializing in residential and commercial contracting work. He makes it a point to hire former inmates because he knows what they're up against. Chris actually knows Danny. They met in prison while they were both incarcerated. Chris, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So now we're at this point in Danny's story, right, where he's really facing up to the years he's got ahead of him behind bars and the right. psychological struggles, right, that come with that. Can you relate to this? Help us understand what it's like to be in Danny's shoes at this point.
I definitely can relate to it. It's important to understand going to prison is the equivalent of being teleported to like another planet. It's different rules. Just, you know, it's stuff that you have to adjust to. And it's very hard, especially when you're young and you're used to, you know, being free. And you're in this new environment where, you know, the rules are different. There are people inside who are probably never get out. You have prison guards who treat you a certain kind of way. Lack of freedom, lack of privacy. And so it takes some very thoughtful soul searching to get your mind right to survive it. And so I definitely relate to his experience.
So you met Danny Miller while you guys were both in prison. Tell me that story, how you got to know him, what kind of a guy he was when you met him.
I think that the point when I met Danny, I was already in prison perhaps for about 7 to 8 years. He came in, I was a little older than Danny, came in pretty quiet. And at this point in my incarceration, I had become a mentor. I had discovered after 1 or 2 years in prison that my path to rehabilitate myself was through education. And so I was going to school. I got my high school diploma, I got my college degree, and I started mentoring. And I realized that, you know, education is a valuable tool, especially for young people when they come into prison. It's like, focus on your education. It just changes you mentally. And so I noticed Danny, a person real quiet, stayed to himself, and he had very good work ethic. He would get up in the morning, would work. And so we just became friends, and we would just talk and share ideas, and just we just stayed friends for a while. I think we spent probably about maybe 6 to 7 years together in prison.
Chris, tell me a little bit more about your own story, your sentence, your years behind bars, and a little bit more about that work you did in approaching the years that you had to serve and how you made the most of them.
Right. Well, like Danny, my charge actually happened like in a split second. You know, I was 17 when I caught my charge. Some older guys were following me. They surrounded me, threatening me. And I just overreacted. At the time, I was losing a lot of friends to gun violence. I'd seen a lot of stuff, a lot of gun violence, and lost a lot of people growing up. And so I overreacted and pulled my weapon that I was carrying at the time, and I ended up taking a person's life. Unlike Danny, I was sentenced to natural life in prison. And so I went in with not much hope at all of ever getting out, and also fell into a deep depression for about a year. I just wasn't sure how I would get out. Along this time period of a year, I also had to do a lot of soul searching about who I was as a person, what led me here. I knew that I was a good person. And was like, how do I prove that to myself and to other people? And I figured it was through education. I was always very studious growing up. I played competitive chess, used to read a lot of books. And I said, well, now I have time to do all these things. So how about I explore, you know, this side of myself and just try to further my education? And so that's what I started doing.
Chris, I want to keep your experiences and your comments in mind as we turn back to Danny's story now. As we're going to hear, Danny came around to being as productive as he could under the circumstances and with the resources at hand.
Some guys, when they go in, you know, they get in gangs, or they start hanging with certain crowds. But somehow I always got like more attached to the older guys. And they always schooled me like, man, you can go to college in here, like things like that. So I got my GED in prison. Like any kind of program that I was able to get into for school, I did it. I got two trades. I took horticulture. I took sheet metal. I took computer repair, but I didn't pass the certification. And I took fiber optic cabling, but I didn't pass the certification. I did college. I got 18 credits. Cause they had like a program with Anne Arundel Community College. I got 18 credits, but I didn't finish that. I didn't finish. But I always like utilized all the good programs, like whatever they had, like anger management, life skills, NA, AA, victims impact. Just whatever program they had, I just did it. Because it also helped you get past the time, help you get off the tier, help you get with yourself a little bit. But at the same time, you learn. I had a lot of hope, you know, because I was in contact with certain other guys that got released. And, you know, I asked him, like, man, how was it to get a job? How you do this? Like, I asked questions. So I was kind of, I had a lot of hope before I came home, you know. I was dealing with this female. I met her while I was there at the jail. She was a dental assistant. So I already knew that when I get out, I got a stable spot to live. And she was a good girl.
Wait a second. I gotta interrupt you here. You met the girl, she was a dental assistant, like, while you were incarcerated?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she came and worked on guys' teeth. Yeah, and you guys hit it off.
Yeah, she was the dental assistant. So, I mean, they're still regular people. You know, they don't like somebody. I mean, but if I was a dental assistant, I had got a job. I was a sanitation guy up there in the infirmary. So every day I went there to clean the floors and get their trash. And we just always had a little small talk, like, how you doing today? It started from that. But I was quiet. I was real quiet. And she like, man, I was different from everybody.
You're tuned to Life in the Balance. I'm Aaron Henkin. We're listening to Danny Miller's story this hour. And here with me in studio is Chris Wilson. Chris is a Baltimore-based social entrepreneur and founder of a number of local businesses. Chris makes it a point to hire former inmates because he is one himself. He met Danny while they were incarcerated. And Chris, we just heard Danny talking about how he made use of the work and educational opportunities that were available in prison. We heard him tell this improbable story of meeting a girl, a sweetheart that he hit it off with. And, you know, as he gets closer to his release date, we hear this word hope from him over and over. Help put us inside the mind of a guy who's coming up on that release date and seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. How real is that feeling of hope, and how realistic is it?
Well, hope is definitely very, very important, especially for folks serving time. Being in prison kind of keeps you like in a holding pattern, and people in the outside world, like, things are just evolving, technology, and it's important to stay up on things that's going on in the outside world. But you also have to make use of the resources in school and therapy and stuff that's available on the inside so that you're prepared to go out. But the hope is definitely important, because we often hear the stories about how easy it is for people to come back to prison, the recidivism rate, definitely how hard it is to find a job. We see gun violence, drugs, everything on the news every day. So we know what we're going back into, and everyone says they don't want to come back to prison. But the key is, how do you equip yourself and educate yourself in a way where you won't come back? And so we're always very, like, anxious about that experience coming out. I mean, I was anxious myself. It's scary, actually.
In a little bit, we are going to hear Danny talk about how things have gone for him since he's been released. And the reality is, it's been a bumpy road. You were a mentor to Danny when you guys were in prison.
Yes.
I know for a fact that you remain a mentor to him.
Right.
Let me ask you what kind of advice you give to Danny these days and other guys that are in his shoes for creating a stable life, a purposeful life after incarceration.
So I give Danny a lot of advice on a bunch of things. But one of the things I emphasize to him every single time I'm around him is that he has to surround himself with good people. Now, the neighborhood that Danny lives in is a tough neighborhood. So it's one of the toughest neighborhoods in Baltimore City. You know, people deal drugs right in front of his building on his stoop. Like, you can't avoid it in this neighborhood. That's one of the challenges for him. It's like he surrounds himself with, like, some of his family members. And it's, how do you tell your family, like, oh, I can't, like, hang around you. But at the same time, you have people in your family that may, like, abuse drugs or just, like, have, like, the bad elements around them. And I tell them all the time that you have to step outside of what you're used to, which is being around folks like that that's doing drugs or whatever. Because Danny's a good dude. Danny gets up. He has great work ethic. He wants the best things for his life, for his son. Surround yourself with people that's amazing, and then you'll have a better experience in life. That's one of the things I tell them all the time.
Chris Wilson, social entrepreneur here in Baltimore, thank you for being with us, and thanks for sharing your perspective.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Aaron Henkin, and you are listening to Life in the Balance. Coming up, being released from the penitentiary doesn't get Danny very far. He ends up taking a job that has him sitting in the prison parking lot every day before work. Stay with us. I'm Aaron Henkin. This is Life in the Balance. And on the program today, we've been following the story of Danny Miller. Danny was a teenager when he was sentenced to 30 years in prison for second-degree murder. And we're going to pick up his story now, 10 years into that sentence, when Danny learns that a decision has been made. He's being released early on parole. After a decade in prison, he finds himself walking out of the gates.
I mean, it felt unreal. And all that, like, when I walked out of that prison gate, it felt unreal. I went straight to the check cashing store because I started saving my money. Like, my last 18 months, whenever I got money orders, I saved them. I didn't spend it. So when I came home to like almost $3,000. But when you get out, they give you a $500 check. They give you $50 cash. It's your own money, though, that you accumulate while you're in there. If you save money, I started saving my money. But everybody get $50 when you get out. Everybody get that. So I had got $50 cash, and they gave me a $500 check. And the rest get mailed to you. You know, go through the state. So I went straight to the check cashing store. Like, going to see a few family members. And then the very next, they put me on GPS. So I had a curfew from 7 to 7. I had a little bracelet on my leg. So it was like certain, I still was like under their control because of the GPS thing. Like, if you, it tell them exactly where you at. So I had to stay away from certain neighborhoods. So I pretty much, I stay in the house a lot. And I was just looking for a job the whole time. Like, I ain't party or nothing. I just came home and really just chilled out. My main focus was like, I want a good job and just build from there, you know. Like, I ain't come home and run to the street or ran to my old friends. Like, nobody even knew I was home. You know, it felt funny. Like, I can get up now, open the refrigerator up. It just felt funny. Using the toilet, and you can shut the door and put the toilet seat down, and everything. I was like, I felt amazed by, like, yeah, everything. I mean, to be honest with you, I got a lot of interviews, and I think because of my name, Danny Miller. My name. That's like a white name. I'm telling the truth, right? Because I got a lot of interviews. Like, whenever I put an application in, I got interviews, but once I got there, I'm going to call you back. And I never got the job. Or, like, that background, that's serious. Like, whenever they did a background check on me, that was it. I mean, I went to parole and probation one day, and this guy, he was complaining, like, man, I hate my job. He was just like, I hate it. And I'm like, man, he got a GPS thing on, too. So I said, excuse me, where you work at? And he told me, like, man, I work for Waste Management. Like, man, go there. They gonna hire you. I'm telling you, they gonna hire you. They hire anybody. And he was right. Like, I went there, and that very same day, they showed me a video. And that next day, I was working. My third week, it was only 9:25 hour, but it was hard because it wasn't on the bus line. So every morning, I had to be to work at 1 o'clock. My girlfriend had to go to work at 8, and she still worked at the jail. And Waste Management was around the corner from the jail. So every morning, I would get in the car with her, and she would drive to the jail, park in the parking lot, and I'd sit in the car all until her lunch break. Her lunch break would be at 12:30, then she'd come out and take me to work. I'd go to work, then she'd get off at 4, go all the way home. I got off at 9:30, then she'd come all the way back to get me. This is my everyday routine. It was hard though, because I was so much money on gas, because she had to go to Jessup, go home, like, And I think it's about like 35 miles going and 35 miles coming. And like I said, man, my day, I had to really go up, get up 8 o'clock in the morning and sit in the car all the way until 12:30. I had my little blanket, and I had a laptop, and I'd be right in the parking lot of the jail. But that was the only way I can get to work. It wasn't no bus line, you know.
Danny Miller sharing his story, a story that finds him out of prison after serving 10 years, but back in that same prison's parking lot, killing time before he works his shift at a sanitation job. Listening to Danny's story along with us now is Karen Stokes. Karen is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore. She was also the first person to hire Chris Wilson, who we heard from in our last segment of our program, after he was released from prison. Karen, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And before we address what we just heard in Danny's story, let me have you talk a bit about Strong City Baltimore, what it is, the work you do there, and the perspective perhaps that you're bringing to our discussion today.
Strong City Baltimore is a 48-year-old organization, so we've been around for a long time. Formerly, we were called the Greater Homewood Community Corporation. About a year and a half ago, we changed our name because we really have been citywide for over a decade. Our mission is really broad. It is building and strengthening neighborhoods and people. So we have a very broad mission and a very holistic approach to what that means for us in terms of how do we really improve neighborhoods in Baltimore and the people who are living in them.
I want to ask you to talk about options or the lack thereof at this point that we're hearing in Danny's story. Employment options, transportation options, and just how vulnerable someone can be when they're in a situation like Danny's.
So transportation remains a huge hurdle for certainly less resourced folks who are really very dependent on public transportation. So in listening to his story, we know that that becomes a constant struggle for everybody. In the work that we do, we run an adult learning center around the city, and people just getting to be able to take a class in preparing for their GED is amazing, that people will sometimes work, you know, two jobs during the day and still try to make it to their class. Transportation is a very big issue.
I'm going to turn our attention back to Danny's story for another few minutes. We're going to hear a little bit now about that sanitation job he was talking about that he got, what that work was like, and where he's gone from there.
We worked on a conveyor belt, and a bunch of trash, it come through at a high speed. And they might have you on aluminum, they might have you on plastic, they might have you on cardboard, like whatever they have you on. If I'm on aluminum, it's a conveyor belt real fast, and you just snatching all the aluminum like this, like nonstop. Like, when I walk in the door, as soon as I get to my workstation, I walk up, and I like this, nonstop. And then the supervisors, they was on your back, like, real hard. Like, man, you're not going fast enough. It's like, it was never, you could never satisfy them. Like, the turnaround rate was so high. And it was many guys that came home from jail, you know. And I lasted 13 months, and I don't know how I did it, because it was hard. I had to come home, had a soaking Epsom salt. I got patches all on my back, Bengay. And it's like I ended up losing that job. And since I lost that job, I ain't bounced back yet. Yet, to this day. Like now, well, I live not too far from here on Pennsylvania Avenue and Martin Luther King Boulevard with another girl. I work for a temp agency, but it's not everyday work. And sometimes I might get a job, and the pay rate ranges from about $8.75. The most I made was $14, but only made $14 one time. And that job lasted 2 days. But for the most part, I mainly get jobs at about $9.50 to the hour, mainly hard labor. The temp agency, like one of the easiest spots to get a job at when you got a background. Like this week right here, I ain't work this week at all. You gotta be there at 5:30 in the morning, and sometimes you'll go there at 5:30 in the morning and just sit and won't get sent out. And you gotta do it every day. And if you don't go, and when jobs do come, they won't pick you. It's like a lose-lose. Like, if I don't go and they don't see my face every day, when jobs come, they won't pick me. But if I go there and I sit there at 5:30 in the morning all the way till 11, 12 o'clock, I could be out looking for another job or something. You see what I'm saying? So I get up in the morning. I have my steel-toe boots on, my work vest, my work hat. And I walk out, and I go there. You sit there, no work. So on my way, I'm like, dang, man. So I, we come back home. And I'd be so like, dang, I go ahead and tell my girl I ain't gonna work today. It's like embarrassing, you know? And I see people like, man, you just getting off work. And I'm like, man, you just don't know, you feel me? So, because when people see me, they think I go to work every day. But I do go to work every day, but I don't work every day, you know?
Danny Miller sharing his story here on Life in the Balance. And listening to that story along with us is Karen Stokes of Strong City, Baltimore. Karen, some people might hear Danny's story and they might say, that's poetic justice. Serves him right. He did the crime. He deserves whatever hardship he has had to endure in prison or after. Employers have the choice to hire whoever they want to hire. When it comes down to the choice between a guy who's got a criminal record and a guy who doesn't, that's the employer's prerogative, right? What do you say to an argument like that?
Well, of course, people do have a prerogative. And there's another element of that is, what else is part of your mission in terms of your work, either as a for-profit or a nonprofit employer? And I think there's an element here of, yeah, people do the time and then it's done. And how do we, because it's in society's best interest, in our city's best interest, if we can find a way of when people are returning citizens, that they are in fact returning to a community that is going to give them a second chance.
You talk the talk, you also walk the walk. I mentioned before you hired the guest we heard in our last segment, Chris. Talk about Chris, talk about meeting him and your decision to hire him.
Well, the interesting thing about Chris is sort of how we do work in Baltimore. So I had a job opening, and it was for a work for somebody to do some community organizing and workforce, connecting in the community in the Barclay neighborhood. And I really wanted somebody from the community. So being a good Baltimorean, what do? I call people I know and say, who do you have? So I called the University of Baltimore, the Community Studies Department, and there's a woman there named a professor, Betsy Nix, who I knew well, and I said, Betsy, who's your rising star at UB? And she said, well, there's this guy who's taking classes here. He's great. His name is Chris Wilson. Maybe you want to interview him. And I said, sure, that's great. And then she was very cautious. She says, well, you should know he's done a little bit of he's done some time. And I said, perfect. It would probably be better for me to have someone with that experience who's going to be working in this neighborhood with folks who we're trying to really connect to. Now, I said that in a very cavalier way. Sure, perfect. Not really knowing anything about Chris or even knowing what kind of time did he serve. So in some ways, perhaps I was a little naive to begin with, but I also understood that we as an organization have an obligation. The people in our neighborhoods that are there who are looking for jobs and they see buildings coming up on, say, Greenmount Avenue and 23rd Street, they are showing up at worksite saying, I need a job. So for me, it was in our self-interest as an organization to have a person out there talking to people. Because what we were trying to do is getting people out of the drug trade and into some kind of work situation. So that was how I was introduced to Chris to begin with.
Talk to me about networks and about that part, that link in the chain, how you found your way to him. I mean, it seems to me one of the differences between Chris, who you hired, and Danny, who's going through the struggles he's going through, it has to do with a network of social and professional contacts.
Absolutely. And I think that is something we need to figure out in Baltimore, is like, how do we create that network? When you go to prison, particularly if you've served a long period of time or if you've done two offenses in there, when you come out, your family is not even necessarily available to you. And some of the friends that you had may not be the people you want to associate with. How do we, in fact, create a network, a mentoring network? And I think it has to be a network, because I think it's too much in some ways to ask an individual to be the mentor for someone coming out of prison. And why is that? Because there are so many things this person needs. They need housing. They need to figure out how to negotiate the medical, the healthcare system. They need to figure out how to even get those construction boots that he talks about. Like, how do you even dress for work? You need someone who might, if you're a woman or even a man, you might need to deal with daycare. So what I think is important is if we could create small networks of people, individuals around to surround somebody, a returning citizen, we might be able to help them get where they need to go. Chris had that network. Chris is a very charismatic, well-educated. He educated himself when he was in prison. He came out and he was on fire to like make, you know, change his life. And people at University of Baltimore recognize that. So I connected to them. Once Chris was in my orbit and in my organization, I now am invested in him. I want him to be a success. So therefore, whatever it's going to take for me to help Chris be successful, he started out part-time. He was very clear to me, I need health care. So the moment I could hire him full-time so I can get him on to get benefits, I did that. So that first foot in the door is really important.
Karen Stokes from Strong City, Baltimore, talking about networking, among other things. Karen, work needs to be done in that area, as you say. You do have some programs that you are affiliated with at Strong City, yeah? That you sponsor, that you invest in, that are helping people like Danny find steady employment, though.
Yeah, and we're trying to figure it out ourselves because a lot of this is new for us as an organization. We do have an adult learning center, so we have 600 learners that come our way. We want to make sure that we provide that kind of network. If someone needs something, we have a learner advocacy program where we have a one-on-one mentoring program for people who are taking that step to get their GED. In addition, we run the VISTA program, and we kind of experimented a few years ago with this. VISTAs are Volunteers in Service to America. They are doing a year of national service. We had a cohort of VISTAs that came to us in the summer of 2015. And we were thinking, wouldn't this be an interesting approach? You're coming out of prison. What you really need is to build your resume and doing some national service, putting time in. Now, you're not going to get a lot of money. You're basically you're making poverty wages. And at the end, you get an education stipend. So you will get like $5,500 at the end of your year of national service. We were exploring as an organization of, can we seek out returning citizens to become VISTAs? For us, we saw it as a real win-win. You come out of prison, you're really giving back in many ways, but you're also beginning to develop that network that we're talking about, and your resume is starting, right? You're gonna develop some real job skills, and you're gonna be contributing back to the community in terms of reducing poverty. Some of the challenges, when we first did it, we were like, oh, this should be easy. Well, it wasn't. People have to get through a criminal background check. We could not hire anybody through the VISTA program that had a convicted murder rate for, murder conviction, or we could not have anyone who found themselves on the National Sex Offender Registry. But everybody else you could. So if you had done drugs or there are other kinds of offenses that you might have had. But it's very difficult. That's one way that we were trying to be open as an organization to how can we, whenever we can, hire somebody who is a returning citizen if they meet all the other skills that we're looking for.
Karen Stokes, CEO of Strong City Baltimore. Karen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the debut episode of Life in the Balance, a new radio show here on WYPR where we'll dedicate each episode to understanding one person's story and exploring the issues, social, economic, and political, that have shaped that story for better or worse. This episode has been dedicated to and in service of Danny Miller, a man convicted of second-degree murder when he was 17, who served 10 years in prison, who was released 6 years ago, and who since then has been continually struggling in his search to find stable employment. We're going to give Danny the last word this hour. It's a thought for potential employers who might be reluctant to hire someone with a criminal record.
I just think that they should give everybody a chance. Just because somebody went to jail before don't mean they're not hard working or they're not skilled in certain areas, Because you never know the circumstances that send somebody to prison. Not saying that it's right, but we get put in a certain predicament sometimes. And that shouldn't affect your work life. How can you say rehabilitate someone and then you send them home and you stuck. So if you can't find a job and things like that, you're going to push somebody back into the street. You might push somebody back into selling drugs and just from selling drugs, you might get into a situation when it turned violent. So now, and the whole time you probably want to sell drugs to make money to live. But just from selling drugs, it's a ripple effect. You end up creating an enemy one way or another. And then violence, you see what I'm saying? So don't just look and say, well, he's been locked up before. Just give people a chance.
Life in the Balance is an original production of WYPR. The show is produced and edited by Katie Marquette. Our theme music comes to us from Wendell Patrick. You can listen back to this episode at WYPR.org/Life in the Balance. And you can reach us with your thoughts and questions at lifeinthebalance@WYPR.org. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.